Gracious God, so often it is easy to stand by and wait for another to take the first step toward reconciliation. We know that we ache inside for peace in our family, peace with our neighbors, peace in our workplace, but we are the wronged party, and we cannot take the step. Or we are the offending party, and we cannot uncover the lie to take the first step. Grant us courage to take that first step. These things we ask in the name of your Son, who became the victim so that he could take the first step. Amen. We're going to look today at the beginning of Joseph's deception of his brothers. On Wednesday, we looked at the brothers' deception of their father. And we'll look at their beginning, the beginning stages of their repentance, and the beginning of the softening of Joseph's heart. Egypt just seems to be the place where hearts get hard, right? Joseph was well educated by his oppressors, I guess, well trained in the Egyptian school of management of oppressed peoples or hungry people. And he has, as we'll see today, a start-stop attempt to make things right within his family. He also has some reasons to check things out, see how deep this repentance goes. But it's a tough road for Joseph, as it is a tough road for his brothers to confession. We'll see the brothers begin their confession of their sins. We'll see Jacob take on some new characteristics that we haven't seen so far in the story. And again, we'll see Joseph get filled out as a fuller person, not simply victim, but victimizer, one who is multifaceted. When we last saw Joseph, he was changing his clothes. He got the king's ring, the robes of authority, which he had as a youth before his brothers threw him into the pit. We see him instituting what I call a windfall profit tax, only because with the oil crisis looming in the Middle East, we may again institute a windfall profit tax if the president sees too much gouging going on at the gas pump. But because the good years are coming, or actually have started when we left the story, at the point where we left the story, Joseph is now taking 20% of the produce. First of all, nobody needs that much food, bless you. But they will need that food in those lean years. So they're storing it up. And we see Joseph starting a family as we leave. So let's look at the end of 41. And would someone begin reading? Well, I'll read 48 and 49 because that's short. And then if someone would get prepared to read 50, and just as soon as I finish, just start us, take us to the end of the chapter. So we gathered all the food of these 7 years, which, oh darn, I'm Peter Nash. This is the... This is the fourth of 5 units on Joseph, on the Joseph story. Sorry, I hope you got the right tape. So we gathered all the food of these 7 years which occurred in the land of Egypt and placed the food in the cities. He placed in every city the food of its own surrounding fields. Thus Joseph stored up the grain in great abundance, like the sand of the sea, until he stopped measuring it, for it was beyond measure. And if someone would pick us up there and take us along.
Before the year of famine came, Joseph had two sons, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. The name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. The 7 years of plenty that prevailed in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. There was famine in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. When all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread, and Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph, what he says to you, do. So when the famine had spread over all the land, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt, to Joseph, to buy grain, because the famine was severe over all the earth.
Okay, thank you. A couple of interesting things here as we close out one part instead of another part. So we get a recapitulation here. First of all, Joseph turns out to be right, but we know that because we have the story and we've all heard him before. And his interpretation of the dreams. The beginning of his family. What about these names? I have, or the etiologies, the little explanations of the names. For he said, God has made me forget all of my trouble and all of my father's house. Can you believe this? That I know it's 20, at least 20 years later, but it has to be sold in this. I don't think the African Americans who were brought here as slaves 20 years later forgot, as the stories tell us, the slave stories, narratives tell us, they remembered. They remembered and they told their children. So it's hard to believe that Joseph actually forgot, put that out of his mind. But he was certainly dealing with the stuff, dealing with his new life and living his new life. And Ephraim, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction.
It sounds like he had reason to celebrate and reason to give thanks despite the past.
Yes.
Like he didn't forget the past, but he found joy anyway.
He went on with his life and moved forward. Yes.
He probably had stopped worrying about it.
Yeah. Stopped, I assume, stopped plotting his revenge. But he's moved forward. And down here, we made some tacky suggestions about the Pharaoh, which I think are being borne out here. The people come to their king, God king, God's representative on earth, and say, we're hungry. He says, go see Joseph. And it could be that he had full confidence in Joseph, or it could be he, as we said today, was distancing himself from the problem and was going to let this ride in Joseph's hands. Now, we know that Joseph was fully competent and God was with him. No sweat whatsoever. But the Egyptian pharaoh is not, in my opinion, a man of Yahweh, and he's going to hedge his bets here. And an interesting look at Joseph here and how well he takes care of his boss. When the famine spread over all the face of the earth, then Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. And the famine was severe in the land. Wasn't this their grain?
That occurred to me.
Didn't he pay for it?
No, he took 20% of the produce, where they had probably been taking 10% before as tax.
Isn't that a little bit like revenue sharing?
Maybe at the afterwards you could explain revenue sharing to me, man. But at any rate, it looks bad here. It looks interesting here. I'm sure that Joseph. No, I'm not sure because I know the end of the story. let's say for the moment that it was a small service fee or a user's fee.
Did he sold it to him without people from wasting it?
I'm sure that would prevent people from hoarding, from coming in and taking way too much and throwing wild parties in the first year, and so that there wouldn't be enough. I mean, because they'd certainly gotten into a consumerist mentality, right? I mean, if you've got all this overabundance, you know, well, you're going to buy, you're going to eat what you don't need, and you're going to throw some things away. But if you have to buy it in a depressed economy, you're going to take more care as to what you consume. So I don't think it's, I don't think it's all negative. I think it's, Joseph has a mixed response. Joseph has several responsibilities here. He has the two most important, to keep the people from dying of starvation, and to support his boss, to make sure that his boss comes out of this okay, this crisis that he knows is going to last for 7 years.
What I find amazing is that for 7 years they have been living on 80%, and now they're living on 20%, it's dropped by 4%, and there's still enough to feed the nations that have come to Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Sound like any other countries you know?
Yeah.
It's nice when I don't have to say it. Let's move to chapter 42. Unless there are other comments about this situation, which will get more interesting as we move along. Someone?
When Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" And he said, "Behold, I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there, that we may live and not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might befall him. Thus the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. How far do you want me to read?
Go down to the next two verses, through 7.
Now Joseph was governor over the land. It was who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. Joseph saw his brothers and knew them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. "Where do you come from?" he said. They said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food."
Okay, thank you. Jacob, who has up till this point in the story been sort of the doddering senior citizen, deceived by the brothers and not really much a part of the picture, now comes to fore, and as we continue along we'll see that he really still has his street smarts. And these are the young vital men. This is the senior, literally the patriarch of the family, actually of the whole nation as we know the story now, who sits at the opening of his tent, and he looks at the brothers, his sons, who are saying, "Gosh, I'm hungry. Crops aren't doing well. We're going to be hungry next year, too, if we're alive. Are you hungry? Did I hear you say you were hungry? I'm really hungry. How about you?" And finally, Jacob says, "Why are you staring at one another? Let's do something about this. I've heard that there's food down there in Egypt. Go down and buy some that we may live and not die." Right? The center of the story here, as I read it, is God sent me ahead to preserve life. Right? So Jacob gets the theme put right into his mouth. Go buy food that we might live and not die. The brothers don't come off too well for the next few episodes here. They're never, except for when the 10, when I say the brothers, the 10 who were part of this conspiracy, only two of them get mentioned, Reuben the firstborn and Judah, the forebearer of the surviving nation of Israel. And the others all sort of act as a clump, and they're all sort of running into each other, sort of like the Keystone Israelites or something. So they came down to Egypt along with all the other peoples of the world. Joseph was ruler over the land. And the brothers came and bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. Have I heard this someplace before? Yeah, I mean, have we been here before?
I think we dreamt it a while ago.
We dreamt it a while ago, okay. And the brothers have done all in their power in sort of classical in the sense of Greek drama to prevent the prophecy from coming true. But as we all know, in classical drama, you do all you can and then still the prophecy comes true. Right? Oedipus has a prophecy that he'll kill his father and marry his mother. So he leaves the country and he still kills his father and marries his mother. And now we have this complex that we all have to worry about growing up. But at least we have a name for it. And the brothers have done all the power, but still the prophecy is going to come true. Prophecy is going to come true, and here we see it. Right? Of course, there are 10 rather than 11, but that's pretty good. And he speaks to them harshly. I can't figure this part out. I'm not that it's so confusing, but whether it's Joseph's gruffness, or if we've all been to the post office or out to get passports or any place where the government workers got to deal with masses and masses of people making demands and everyone wanting to be an exception, and you get up to the front of the line and go, what do you want? Speaking harshly to them. Well, this guy's got the whole known world coming to him. Pharaoh's not dealing with anything, right? On the food front, the whole world is coming in. So it may be that this is the beginning of Joseph's starting to work out his anger, this 20 some years of anger with his brothers, or it may just be the cover. Because everyone gets talked to gruffly. Because listen, we've got a long line of people out there starving. We've got to feed everybody, as many as we can before the day is done. But he speaks to them harshly, and he does speak to them a little more harshly, perhaps. Someone pick us up with 8.
Although Joseph had recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. He remembered the dreams he had had about them and said, "You are spies. You come to spy out the weak points in our defenses." "No, my lord," they answered, "your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies." "No," he maintained, "it is to spy out our weaknesses that you have come. Tell me when to stop." "They say there are 12.
Go through 17.
"They said that there are 12 of us, my lord, all brothers, sons of one man back in Canaan. The youngest is still with our father and one is lost. Joseph insisted, as I have already said to you, you are spies. This is how you will be put to the test. Unless your youngest brother come here, I swear by the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place. Send one of your number to fetch your brother. The rest of you will remain in prison. Thus your story will be tested to see whether you are telling the truth. If not, then by the life of Pharaoh, you must be spies." With that, he kept them in prison for 3 days.
Okay. Joseph, there was a comment about why maybe, a couple days ago, about why maybe Jacob liked Joseph. Well, Joseph here seems to be a lot like Jacob in the way he deals with people and how shrewd he is. He's a sharp negotiator. He's a sharp debater. Starts We know that everybody goes back and Simeon stays in prison, but his first words are, the first ante is, one of you will go back and bring the boy, the younger one, and the rest of you will stay here in prison. You know, so now he's got everybody's attention. Yeah, it's not, am I going to be the one who stays? Maybe I'll get to go back and be out of trouble. It's, oh no, only one of us. Odds are it's not going to be me. Only one of us is going to go back. He's got everyone's attention. And then he puts everybody in prison for how many days?
3 days.
This number seemed to be significant to these people. At least a literary device. 3 more days before your head is removed from you, before you're hanged. 3 more days before you're returned to your cupbearership. Puts the brother in prison for 3 days. And of course, some other part of this religion picks up those 3 days later on with somebody with a Greek name that means Joshua. Something about a tomb, I remember. Well, the brothers, we've got this nice little form here of accusation followed by denial, accusation followed by accusation with some detail, followed by denial with some detail. And nobody's being quite honest. Well, this is the beginning of Joseph's deception. First of all, he sees them, recognizes them, and doesn't say anything. That is sort of like the deception that we saw back in 37. Look at this. Do you recognize it? Do you recognize it? Nakar, this word for recognition. And now Joseph recognizes, but isn't recognized and doesn't say anything. So we're pivoting around this recognition theme as the subtle, not overt, but very real deception going on. You have a question?
Well, I noticed something in here too. They're still carrying out that lie. You know, that we've got one brother that's lost. I mean, for all intents and purposes, as far as they know, this guy's not around. They don't recognize him. To the fact that, you know, it struck me that have they told this lie so often that they believed it themselves, to the point that even Jacob said, keeps Benjamin back because he seems to not really totally trust them.
Whether he doesn't totally trust them or he's just clinging on to the last vestige of the love of his youth, the only offspring of that, you know, the only perpetuation of that union, isn't clear. But certainly these guys, at the very least, they're not very bright as they're presented here, and Jacob will point that out to them a couple times in the next couple chapters. Duh, why did you tell this guy that there were 12 of you? He can count. He can see that there are 10. Yeah. And we are honest men. I'm sorry, can you imagine Joseph in the chair? What? But no. Oh, it's a shrewd bargainer. He sits there as an Egyptian officer and says, oh. No, I think you're spies. You look like spies to me. Yes?
I've heard a few, more than a few sermons about how Jesus' disciples say, duh, a few times.
Yeah.
And Jesus continues to try to teach them. So I see some parallels here.
Oh, yeah. One of the things that my mission in life is, and you heard some of this, those of you who were here on Monday, and unfortunately, for those of you who were the previous Monday, you heard the same thing. If you want to understand the New Testament, you got to read the Old Testament. I mean, these are the stories that they worked from. And so the life of Jesus, and to some extent the lives recorded in the epistles, those stories, are framed from, or are borrowed from these. The themes are picked up. The cycles work out in the same way. They're very, very much related in hearing these stories. Then the twist that come in the New Testament, the new freedom that comes in the New Testament, makes so much more difference. You see people break out of the patterns like this pattern of deception that started with Jacob and permeated his family right up until the time that they're almost reconciled. That we see those get broken in the new, those kinds of patterns get broken in the new covenant, in the New Testament, or as I call it sometimes, the secondary testament. So the ten, and especially the eight who don't get named, get presented as, like I said, you know, keep bumping into themselves, trying to kind of claw their ways up. Just an interesting, at least to me, and since I'm teaching, you have to listen. philological comment: you've come here to spy out the weakness of the land. The weakness is actually nakedness, that unprotected part, as the defenseless part, as some places is put. And that's the same word that comes up in Genesis 3 as we move into the story of the serpent. And it's a play on words, the word for nude and shrewd, as Bernard Anderson at least threatens sometimes to translate it. Now, the people, or the man and the woman, they were nude, and the serpent was shrewd. They were undefended. They weren't ready for the attack or the approach of sin that was coming. Just, you know, next time you look at Genesis 3, you might think of this story, that this use of the word. It does mean to be unclothed, and it also means to be unprotected. It's the spot that spies would look for. And verse 9, Joseph remembers, what does he remember? Does he remember being sold into slavery? No, he remembers the dream. That's an interesting, as one of the people in the first Bible study pointed out, that's interesting. So we're not getting clearly revenge here, we're getting maybe vindication. This, you know, the prophecy has come true. Here they are, and they're bowing down before me, as I dreamed.
That was right after all.
Yeah. And maybe there is some purpose in all of this mess. And that's the end of that page. And then as we move into the next section, we begin to see the first confession on the parts of the brother, on the part of the brothers, again en masse, and Reuben's interesting response and the beginning of the weakening of Joseph. So let's go ahead with 18 through 28, through 24, if someone would read that for us.
On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined in your prison, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households. And bring your youngest brother to me, so that your words will be verified, and you shall not die." And they did so. Then they said to one another, "In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he besought us, and we would not listen. Therefore is this distress come upon us." And Reuben answered them, "Did I not tell you not to sin against the land? But you would not listen. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood." They did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. Then he turned away from them and wept. And he returned to them and spoke to them. And he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes.
Okay. I just told you what here, but let's look at it in detail. This is, again, the guys kind of turn around and bump into one another, and they bump into one another in a sense because, and this time it's a good stumbling because they don't realize that Joseph can understand them. And they make this confession. We are guilty. And they have a theology of sort of what goes around comes around, even 23 years later. We did this to Joseph, and now we're paying for it. And it's interesting, as the story is told, it's the first thing that comes to mind. Right? I mean, this has been festering for the whole family for 20-some years. And boom, you know, something wrong happens to all of them in that same group, and they realize right away, oh, here it is. Joseph is in this situation. I've been entering the conversation and remains disguised in spite of the fact that now he has this confession. We've done wrong. The confession is there. Joseph isn't ready yet. He turned away and wept. He didn't reconcile. He went by himself to deal with this grief, not ready to move back into the family structure. He has some testing to do. You know, how sincere is this repentance? Is my brother still alive? Really? Because look what they said about me. Is my father still alive? What are the family obligations here? And there's a thing that goes on in 21 that's interesting. In chapter 37, we didn't hear anything about Joseph's pleading or his distress. It was just boom, boom, boom. But here in 21, when they confess, they remember the agony of Joseph. Don't do this, brothers. Don't do this. They remember it then, when they're the victim. And Joseph is hearing this, and this is where Joseph gets multidimensional for us for the first time, is that he weeps, but he regains composure, and he takes the dagger and he sticks it in and he twists it. He takes one of them. I mean, he's eased up some. There's some hope. But then he takes one of them and he binds him. What happened to Joseph before he was thrown in the pit? They seized his cloak, they bound him, and they threw him in the pit. He takes Simeon, has him bound before their eyes, and sends him back to the dungeon. Right? You remember, but I really want to remind you of what happened 20-some years ago. Never letting on that he knows what happened. He puts the image before them. So Joseph is softening, but he's holding the line of he's got to have not only vindication, but some time to work out this anger. I don't think you'll find this twist in the New Testament. But look and see. And there's more softening as we pick up in 25 through 27. Then Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to restore every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. And thus it was done for them. So they loaded their donkeys and departed with their grain and departed from there. And as one of them opened his sack to give to his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money, and behold, it was in the mouth of his sack. Then he said to his brothers, "My money has been returned, and behold, it is even in my sack." And their hearts sank, and they turned trembling to one another, boom, 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 saying, "What is this that God has done to us?" Right? We can't go back there. It's like when you get too much money from the bank. What am I going to do? I've got this money, and that's great, but I can't go back and tell them. First of all, they'll probably say, "They didn't make a mistake anyway." That's what they always say when I tell them they're short. We told them we were honest men. How are we going to go back and get Simeon out? We're really in a bind here. But Joseph sees that they get their food and they get their money back. Jump ahead to verse 35. When they get home, And they've told the story to their father. And father says, oh, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 9. There were 10 of you. I can't send you boys anywhere, but one doesn't come back. And they tell him about Simeon and the deal, and we'll look at that in just a second. But in 35, now it came out as they were emptying their sacks, that behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were dismayed. Odd reaction. You know, the cash stations are spitting money at me. You know, that's fine. I'll just hang on to it. Open a new account, wait for them to come get it. Well, maybe. But if I'm out with my brothers and we've bought a bunch of stuff, and I look in my bag, and not only are all the things that I bought there, but all the money is there in my brother's bag, I'm going to check my bag too. I mean, this is a several days journey, you know, up from Egypt. Why didn't anybody else figure this out? And that comes up later as they're leaving after they take Benjamin down. These guys, they don't seem to learn from experience. When in the story, when Benjamin goes down and they're going out and the silver cup is planted, you know, you've left once and you found the gold, the money in the bag, and then you didn't check, and you got home and you found all the money. Well, why not check before you leave in the morning? Just check, yeah. But they're not presented in a very positive light as far as I read the story. But most importantly, aside from my making light of them, we see Joseph weakening, but continuing to test to see how sincere they are. And we see more of Jacob's shrewdness as we look at let's see here, Jacob's conversation with Reuben, where he tells the brothers that they really should have crafted their answers, should have spoken only when spoken to, and when asked questions, they should have crafted their answers a little more carefully to avoid this problem. He knows that Simeon's down there, and in 36, and their father Jacob said to them, "You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and you would take Benjamin. All these things are against me." Then Reuben spoke to his father, saying, "You may put my two sons to death." Wait, am I reading the right spot here? We'll finish up and then we'll be done with it. We'll have to look at it again because Judah does virtually the same thing. "You may take my two sons and put them to death if I do not bring them back to you. Put him in my care, I will return him to you." But Jacob said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he alone is left. If harm should befall him on the journey you are taking, then you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol and Sarah." We've seen that about Joseph, right? That's the same speech about the rest of my life. I'm already in mourning for the rest of my life. How can I be for the rest of my life in mourning, in double mourning? And there's a real picking up of that earlier theme of the loss of this beloved son, of these beloved sons.
I find one of the things interesting here is that he's saying, killed your two grandchildren if I don't come back.
Yeah, great offer, right?
Oh, boy. Is that a great offer, though?
Yeah, one of the things though, that you have to understand is that in the it makes the Middle East make more sense when you read this text as a real text, not just as a caricature. That if someone kills a member of my family, one of the requirements of the covenant, of the family obligation, the covenant starts small and moves out. First in the family, then the extended family, then the further extended family, then the whole nation of Israel. So the first obligation is to the family. Someone kills my son, my obligation is to kill his son. Or someone kills my brother, the obligation is to kill him. If I'm responsible for your son and I let him die, you're responsible now for my children, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. That's how the balance was maintained. If I lose, you lose. If I win, you win. Puts a very different...
It also perpetuates itself.
Yeah, it does. But it can be a real deterrent. Maybe this is where nuclear deterrence policy came from.
It's a deterrent, but if it happens, it perpetuates.
Yeah. Well, not it's one for one. You know, once then I've the word is shalem, which is related to shalom. It's an intensive form of the verb. It means to make shalom, make the balance recur. Once I've reinstituted the balance, so to speak, you're not obligated to come and take another one of my sons. And it's interesting that it's two sons. Reuben is, in a sense, acknowledging his loss of two of Jacob's sons here, because he's the firstborn. You're not obligated to keep going. It's not a blood feud. It's a keeping of the balance. So it doesn't perpetuate itself.
Well, it's surprising to me, though, that it's here in this case, it's within the same family.
Mm-hmm.
It's not across families.
But they're two fathers.
Yeah.
So Jacob's first, although we look at our grandchildren differently, or we think, at least as the picture is painted here, we look at them differently. Jacob's loss first is his son. And then the potential loss of his son. The grandsons are his, but they're Reuben's. Reuben would have the same loss as Jacob had.
Is that because of the ownership of children?
I think in part. I mean, the children are they're the social security system.
So instead of two grandsons being offered as a sacrifice, which would be a loss for Jacob. It's in that society, in that time, it's more of Reuben's offering his two boys.
Yes.
They are his to offer.
Yes.
No loss to Jacob implied.
Well, equal loss to Reuben as was lost to Jacob and his sons. I've wronged you. You may exact the same loss from me. Last week we talked about shalom, and that's one of the things I didn't stress very much, but it's one of the painful parts of shalom. It really is a system wherein everyone does well or everyone does poorly. But it doesn't need to spiral. Unfortunately, human beings are involved and not machines, and so it does occasionally spiral. And we make alliances instead of always in concentric circles, with circles that cross, so that we all don't have the same obligations, even though we're in one circle together. At some points, we're not always in the same circle. And if you read the story of the David's merging of the northern and southern kingdom after the death of Saul, with Abner and Joab having some old outstanding family debts to pay, Abner having slain Joab's cousin, Joab is obligated to kill Abner. He's also obligated in the covenant that David has made as his commander. But the family obligation comes first, and he endangers the whole kingdom by fulfilling that. It does get complicated. Yikes. Well, in 43, now the family, so we've got that story. 43 starts with now, which tells us we're jumping ahead, that we're moving the story along. When the grain was all gone, Jacob says, go back. Judah says, now without Benjamin, we told you what was up. Notice it switched from the firstborn, Reuben, to the hero of the southern kingdom, the forebearer of the southern kingdom, Judah. And Judah really, he started his rehabilitation already in saving Joseph's life. He moves farther in his Nixonian rehabilitation in politics here, with this, when he convinces his father to let him take Benjamin down. But it, on the way, Joseph says, hey, why did you guys not craft your answers carefully? Why did you not, why did you tell them there were 12? Why don't you say, look, we're 10 brothers? I mean, Jacob is pretty practiced in this craft of deception, and he can't believe that his sons haven't figured it out. And maybe someone asked today about Joseph, maybe that's why Joseph is his favorite. Joseph is pretty good at that, as we've seen, asking the right questions and giving the right answers. So Judah makes basically the same offer that Reuben does, because the food is gone, the situation is a little different now. Jacob says, okay, take him. But look at 14. As he lets him take him. Take your brother also, 13, and arise and return to the man. And may God Almighty grant you compassion in the sight of the man, that he may release you and your other brother, whatever his name is, and Benjamin. All right. So he says, go ahead. And he blesses them by the name of El Shaddai, the Almighty God. But we talk about, in our culture, Jewish mothers and their ability to inflict guilt. Well, they learned it from an Israelite father. Or an Israel father. Oh, look at this. Go ahead, take your brother. May God grant you compassion. You have my blessing. I hope you all get back. But if you don't, as for me, if I am bereaved of my children... I am bereaved of my children. But go ahead, do what you want to do. And it's a blessing and an injunction and a warning and a pleading that all gets wrapped up in this verse 14.
I wonder how long all this took. It says that when they'd eaten the grain.
Mm-hmm.
They must have brought it back by a lot.
Oh, you got to assume... months worth, at least months worth. Yeah, I mean, when you go down to buy grain in your agricultural society, it's because your crops have failed, and you've got to at least plan through the next planting season. So at least through the next planting season.
Showed a lot of concern for that brother in Egypt.
Yeah. Yeah, someone mentioned it this morning that this is in a sense the root of the whole problem, is that Jacob showed favoritism to the sons of Rachel, and that everything got out of whack at the beginning, and again he's doing it. You can't, you know, Simeon's sitting in prison, well he's gone, but Benjamin you can't take, and finally he capitulates and let Benjamin go, and he doesn't even get mentioned by name. So there's still a problem here at the Jacob level of the story.
See, I forgot whose son was Simeon.
I think he's... I think he's Leah's. He's either Leah's or Leah's maidservant. I'm pretty sure he's not Rachel's maidservant. I'll let you look it up while we go ahead if you want to look back. Let's look at 16 through 25. The highlights here are that Benjamin arrives and he receives, he gets red carpet treatment. Interesting when he says they'll dine, kill a goat, sort of a celebration. They'll dine with me at lunch, even though Egyptians don't eat with anyone else. And when they bring the food out, Jacob gets a bath. Benjamin gets five times as much as their brother, so they really had a party after this long trip. And they come right in and they say, hey, showing their good faith, all our money was here, so we've brought, oh, Jacob's street smarts. Sorry, let's go back up to 11 for a minute. Then their father Israel said to them, if it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best products of the land in your bags and carry them down to the man as a present. A little balm, a little honey, aromatic gum, myrrh, pistachio, and almonds. And take double the money in your hand. Take it back so you can pay for what you brought before and so you can buy yet more. All right. So So they get down there and they try to make restitution. And so there's the process here is making restitution for the little sin because they can't do anything about the real big one as far as they know. And
in the original, is the reason is pistachio nuts?
Yeah, pistachios are a big...
They grow over there.
Yeah,
that's a big
yeah. Product. And as a matter of fact, in the Neolithic period, the New Stone Age, before, let's see, let me know, 7,000, that was part of the basic diet of the hunter-gatherers in the area. And they found them in little Neolithic pots and in Neolithic sites.
No, it always surprised me that they come out with a specific kind of nut.
Yeah.
Rather than just saying nuts.
Yeah. Well, they knew what grew there. Yeah, and it may be, let's see, what other, do they have other, well, almonds and pistachios? Maybe they're just the two kinds of nuts that they had available to them. But they weren't red, I don't think. They didn't leave their fingers.
They probably weren't roasted at the time.
Right.
Excuse me, going back to our question.
Yes.
Leah was the mother of Simeon.
Leah. Thank you.
29:33.
Thank you.
29:33.
Let's see. There's more concealment and testing that goes on here as we move to the end of chapter 43 and 26. When Joseph came home, they brought into the house. Wait a second. Ready to work? Okay. When Joseph came home, they brought into the house to him the present which they had in their hand and bowed to the ground before him. So more recognition for Joseph, the dream. Right? And this time there are 11, so it's really fulfilled now, that first dream. And more concealment on his part, and more testing. Then he asked them about their welfare, about their shalom, and said, "Is your old father well of whom you spoke? Is he still alive?" And they said, "Your servant, our father, is well. He is still alive." And they bowed down in homage. So again, it's fulfilled. It's like, drive this home. This dream really came to pass. He lifted his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and he said, "Is this your youngest brother of whom you spoke to me?" And he said, "May God be gracious to you, my son." The Aaronic blessing here. The Lord be gracious to you. Yahweh. Wait, this is just God, though. Again, we've still got God language in the Egyptian situation rather than Yahweh language. He looks at him and gives him a blessing. And then he hurries out of the room because his heart is softening again. He's welling up with compassion. Yes, my family is still intact. Maybe there's some possibility for reconciliation with my brothers. He sought a place to weep and entered the chamber and wept there. And when he washed his face, he came out and controlled himself. What a man, huh? Serve the meal! And then the description of how the Egyptians ate one place, he ate by himself, and the brothers ate by themselves. And this is the passage about, he took portions to Benjamin from his own table, but Benjamin's portion was five times as much as any of theirs. So they feasted and drank freely with him.
What does verse 33 mean? That they were seated in birth order?
Yeah. So Reuben first, Benjamin at the end. And again, the tradition is if anybody gets more, who's it going to be? Yeah. Reuben, his firstborn, birthright, so to speak. And Benjamin should get less. But Benjamin gets five times as much. Again, a little twist here on Joseph's part. And they're about to leave, and then we'll tell this part of the story, and then we'll have to give it up. Benjamin gets set up here. We set up the other brothers before by putting stuff back in their bags, but now we take a specific thing and set up the baby to see how they'll react. Will they leave him alone like they left me alone? One and two is the setup. Fill the men's bag with food as much as they can carry. Put each man's money in the mouth of his sack, and put my cup, the silver cup. So this is some symbolic cup. It's not just any old silver cup that's lying around. In the mouth of the sack of the youngest, and his money for the grain. And they did as Joseph had told them. As soon as it was light, the men were sent away with their donkeys, just as they had gone out to the city. Now, maybe it's the way Joseph rousted them and sent them out. But, you know, as I said before, if you'd gone out before and found money in the bag, wouldn't you check, you know, before you left? I mean, it dismayed them. It caused them great distress. And yet they don't check before they go. And this time it's real trouble because look at the challenge that comes here. You know, poor Judah, he's got his boys back in Canaan. And then there's this more negotiating. We're honest men. We didn't steal anything. Honest, honest, honest. We'll all be your slaves if one of us is found with it. Says, no, far be it from me to do something like that. And don't you know, you don't know who you're dealing with. I have the power of divination. I can tell who the bad guy is. And it's really a subtle testing to see if these guys have got any smarts at all. Do you know who you're dealing with? Don't you know I can divine? Can you recognize me, brothers? And still the answer is no. So the test goes a little farther. In 14, they're falling on the ground before him again. And Joseph says to them, what is this deed that you have done? Paraphrase that part. And then in 18 and following, the Judah library is complete and fully rehabilitated, and he gets this wonderful speech where he finally convinces Joseph that these brothers will not do to Benjamin what they had done to Joseph 20-some odd years before. Really a powerful speech. We don't have time to read it today, but 34 it ends with, for how shall I go up to my father if the lad is not with me, lest I see the evil that would overtake my father. You know, real concern, not only for Benjamin, but for the father, and that's the thing that convinces Joseph. And then 45, first verse, then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood before him. He cried, have everyone go out from me. So there was Joseph. There was no one with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. They're still sort of, duh. They still don't recognize their brother after all these cues and clues. I mean, concern for his own brother. I have the power of divination. The gifts in the bags, but now he reveals himself, and we'll save the rest for tomorrow, because that's what I promised for tomorrow, is the center of the story. God sent me ahead to preserve life.
How does that word dismayed, is there a better word for translations in 40, verse 3? You could not answer them, but they were dismayed.
45 verse 3. Let's see.
King James says troubled.
Troubled? Yeah. The revised English Bible says dumbfounded.
Yeah.
Surprise.
That
was
made seem just.
I don't know this word. It's not a very common word for being troubled. It's not the word I expected to find here, which means to be trembling. It's I think related to being confused, but I have to check in the lexicon because this isn't one that.
Well, I certainly would think it was shocked.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
It's an understatement.
Yeah. Dumbfounded, confused is what I think lies behind this, but I've never seen this word used this way. So. Thank you for your time and your attention, and tomorrow we will do as much wrapping up of this story as we can. Read through the rest of 45 if you haven't read already, and read 50 after the death of Israel, because what looks like reconciliation when Israel gets down, Jacob/Israel gets down to Judah, when he dies, the whole can of worms opens up again for the brothers. So you got to read 50. Thanks.
Thank you.